there is a definite connection between the beginning of this week's parasha and the end of last week's parasha. In fact, it's somewhat interesting to see why the Chumash ended the whole story of Bilam, where it ended it, and then it left like a couple of details for the next week, for Pinchas. So just like to recap a little bit what we saw at the end. After Bilam had failed in his attempt to curse the Jews, on a number of occasions he tried, it didn't work. At the end, he comes up with a plan B, that instead of cursing them, he'll try to seduce them. So then we're told at the end of the parasha how the daughters of Midian go down. Excuse me, the daughters of Moab go down, also some of Midian, but mainly the daughters of Moab go down, and they attempt to ensnare the Jewish men. Then we're told that a plague hits. At the end of the parasha, we're told that 24,000 people die. It's interesting that some of the mystical sources connect these 24,000 with the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva that died. I remember my son, Matityahu, he asked me that when he was around 6 or 7 years old. He said, "Hold it, are the 24,000 here connected?" And I said, "It sounds pretty good." But and if you just want to think a little deeper, we know that the students of Rabbi Akiva died because they didn't treat one another properly. Similarly, we know that the Second Temple was destroyed because people hated one another, which therefore means they didn't treat each other properly. So it's therefore extremely appropriate that this portion is read right as the 3 weeks begin. And therefore, Parshas Pinchas, actually, Balak was last week before the 3 weeks, and Pinchas is now during the 3 weeks. So it's very interesting that we have that connection at this time of year when we're mourning the destruction of the temple. There are most likely deeper issues involved as far as the ideology which was being used, but that will leave. We're told then that a leader of the Jews, a leader of one of the tribes, or more specifically, it says, I'm reading now the end of last week's portion, chapter 25, verse 6. Vinei ish mi bnei Yisrael ba vayikrev el echav es hamidyonis lenei Moshe lenei kol adas bnei Yisrael vehem abochim pesach ol moed. Translation reads, "Behold, a man of the children of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman near to his brothers in the sight of Moshe and in the sight of the entire assembly of the children of Israel, and they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting." That here we have an anonymous man, an anonymous woman, some type of public display taking place, and it says they were weeping. The Midrashim, the Talmud tell us that who was weeping? The children of Israel were weeping. The Torah wants to spare us from the exact description of what takes place in front of the tent of meeting. But evidently it was this public sexual display. And then we're told that Pinchas comes and Pinchas is a vigilante, a fanatic, and he attacks the two of them, he kills them on the spot, and then it says that's the end of the plague. We turn the page and we begin this week's portion. It tells us, and God said to Moshe, "Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen, has turned back my anger from the Jewish people in his zealousness when he avenged God within the people." And therefore it says that he's going to receive a covenant of peace. Now, first of all, it is a little strange. Here's a man who does violence and he receives for his violence peace. Here's a man who murders, and the next verse tells us, and therefore he and his descendants will now be Kohanim. I mean, it sounds almost bizarre. I'll just mention a point that you may not know. There is a law, and it's actually brought down clearly in the Zohar, in this week's portion. There is a law that says that a Kohen who kills can no longer function as a Kohen. Why? A Kohen is meant to bring someone close to God. The Talmud says a Kohen who killed can't bless the people. Why? Tosis explains, hands that were full of blood can now not serve as a conduit to bring God's blessing down into the earth. It's almost contradictory ideas. So therefore, a Kohen who kills can't function as a Kohen. So how could it be that Pinchas, because he kills, now becomes a Kohen? Commits violence, receives peace, kills, and receives the Kohen. I actually thought that it could be that that's the reason that Pinchas wasn't a Kohen till this time. For had he been a Kohen, he would have become inappropriate to be a Kohen the second that he killed. But being that he wasn't a Kohen earlier, so then perhaps he is still fit to be a Kohen, because he is not a Kohen he killed. He's a person who kills. But that sounds like a technicality, but I want you to remember another thing. Who was the first Kohen?
Aaron.
Aaron also had a, shall we say, a sordid episode in his life. When? Aaron leads the worship of the golden calf. Now, Aaron does it for good reasons. But still, you would say idolatry is idolatry. A man who commits idolatry, how can he later become a Kohen Gadol? How can he become the high priest in the temple? So if Tzaddik HaKohen from Lublin, one of the great Kabbalistic, Hasidic teachers, he says that Aaron becomes a Kohen Gadol, not despite the fact that he was guilty of the golden calf, but because he was guilty of the golden calf. That he was willing to go through so much self-sacrifice, and he was and Aaron's thinking is like this. Aaron says, better for me to sin than for the whole nation to sin. Better than to do it, and better than them doing it, it's better that I do it. And Aaron tried to take the brunt of what he saw coming. Again, I don't want to get into that much detail here, but it says that the people approached a man named Hur and asked Hur to build him a calf. And Hur said, absolutely not, so they killed him. So Aaron said, better than them being guilty of killing again and killing me, not because he wanted to live, better than they be guilty for killing me, better I'll build the golden calf. So a man who is willing to sacrifice himself for the people obviously shows leadership qualities, and that's why he becomes Kohen Gadol. So if we'll follow this through, it could be Pinchas, who does something which is extremely unpopular, and that the Talmud spells out, and perhaps we'll have time to get into it a bit more. But one of the things it says is that the other people, the masses, attacked Pinchas and said, what kind of thing is this to go and killing people? What kind of thing is this vigilantism? And you understand what's behind this. On the one level, Moshe Rabbeinu does nothing. Why doesn't Moshe do anything? Moshe stands and watches this. Why doesn't Moshe do anything about this situation? Moshe? No, it's a very simple problem. The woman that was brought over here was a woman from Midian. Where was Moshe's wife from? She was from Midian. So therefore, the Talmud spells it out. It says the Zimri, that's the man's name, we'll get to it. He pulls this woman by the hair, and it says he pulls in front of Moshe and says, permitted or not permitted, or prohibited. And then he goes further. And if you're going to tell me prohibited, then where's your wife from? Why, for you it's okay, and for me it's not okay. So therefore, Moshe is rendered, I don't want to say useless, but Moshe can't speak now, because Moshe is personally involved in the case. A judge who's personally involved has to disqualify himself, if anyone's been following the news recently. So Moshe disqualifies himself and doesn't speak. On the other hand, Pinchas is standing there, and Pinchas says, Moshe, isn't this the law? And Moshe says, absolutely. So he goes ahead and he kills them. But now the people turn and say, hold it, if Moshe didn't take action, how can you take action? So you see the terrible thing they accused him of? How dare you be more religious than Moshe? People do that all the time today. What? You're going to be firmer than the Chazon Ish? You're going to be firmer than this or that? What right do you have to be so firm? Who do you think you are over here? If Moshe didn't do anything, then how can you respond? And the masses were against him. More than that, Rashi here mentions a couple traditions, why he gives his whole lineage, Pinchas from Elazar, from Aaron the Kohen, to tell you that Pinchas is from Aaron. And where else would he be from? His grandfather is Aaron. Ah, who is his other grandfather? So none of you did Rashi this week. Who is his other grandfather? Yisro. Pinchas' other grandfather was Yisro. So the other people accused the behavior that he was guilty of as being pagan behavior. They said Yisro, who was a pagan, the pagan philosophy or genes are within Pinchas, and therefore he's acting like his grandfather Yisro. So the Torah comes and says, no, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Pinchas is just like Aaron. But now we appreciate the deeper understanding because Aaron also is going to sacrifice himself for the sake of his people, just like Pinchas. It doesn't make a difference what public opinion is going to say. It doesn't make a difference what people are going to do to him. Pinchas is acting because he knows that it's the right thing to do, and Pinchas goes and he acts and he stands up for the sake of God, as it were. So therefore, Pinchas receives two rewards. One reward is the reward of becoming a Kohen, and the other is this covenant of peace. Now, actually, with the covenant of peace, the mystical understanding of this is that Pinchas, because of the covenant of peace, will never die. And according to Jewish sources, Pinchas then later assumes another identity, and who's that? Oh, it's good you came today. Who? Eliyahu Hanavi. The teaching Zohar says Pinchas is Eliyahu. Eliyahu is Pinchas. And Eliyahu Hanavi, we know, lives on forever. Eliyahu is also full of fanaticism toward God. I mean, the direction of God, protecting God's interests. So therefore, the personality of Pinchas is continued in the personality of Eliyahu. And Eliyahu, of course, we know, never dies. Eliyahu goes up in his chariot of fire, up into the heavens. And therefore, Pinchas' covenant of peace, we understand, guarantees him eternal life. But there's something going on in this portion that I want to identify. Close the door. There's something that I want to identify, which, in my mind, is a watershed between something that happened in Bereishis to something that will take place later on in Dvarim. And there is a whole theme which therefore carries through, let me just think quickly, I can show it through Bereishis, Shemos, Bamidbar, Dvarim, four of the five books. I could, off the top of my head, I don't have anything in Vayikra right now. But through four of the five books, I can show a theme going through, which I think will allow us to penetrate the basic understanding of the text. But before I get there, let's just see who all the players are. On the one hand, now we know who Pinchas is. Pinchas is from which tribe? Tribe of Levi. Pinchas is the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen. It's from there for the tribe of Levi. Parshas Pinchas, as I said from the beginning, it waited to give us the identity of the other two. Who were they? The man's name is Zimri. Torah now fills in the missing information, and it says in verse 14, "V'shem ish Yisrael hamukeh asher huka es hamidyonis Zimri ben Salu." And the name of the man of Israel was Zimri, the son of Salu, Nisi beis av l'Shimoni, one of the leading men in Shimon, for the tribe of Shimon. And the woman, v'shem ha'isha hamukeh hamidyonis Kozbi bas Tzur, Kozbi, the daughter of Tzur. According to some, Tzur may even be the same person as Balak. And it goes one step further. Rosh Umos Beis Av Midyanhu, one of the leading families in Midyan. So this is interesting. Pinchas, on his side, is from Aaron, a grandson of Aaron, one of the leading families in Shimon, in Levi. Zimri comes from one of the leading members of Shimon, from the leading family, family of princes. Kozbi is the daughter of either a leading family or maybe even the king himself. Which means that every place we look, we see aristocracy. It leads us to believe that this is not a coincidence. It wasn't just a situation, you know, of higher class people, you know, attending the same parties and therefore meeting one another. Yeah? Correct. It's generally the people that are in leading positions, the ones that are most likely to feel that they are somehow slighted, when because they're the ones who will suffer more from jealousy. But over here, and according to the Medrash, this man is the lead, is the head of the tribe. He is the head of the tribe of Shimon. We're told in both the Talmud and the Medrash that the tribe of Shimon was the largest tribe, I believe. It had 59,000 people, one of the largest. I think it was the largest, 59,000 people in it. And when... So I'm not getting ahead of myself. But when this woman came, she was told to give yourself up only to Moses. Why? That this was a plot. It's one thing, I don't know if you know this, but the Russians accused the Americans at one point of starting the AIDS epidemic. You know that, right? And the Arabs accused the Jews of doing it. So there you go. Is that they infected all the call girls, right? All the prostitutes, they infected with the AIDS epidemic, and then they sent them, you know, of course, to try to infect people. So it's one thing that you can say that you're going to send out the prostitutes. Another thing, the daughter of the king. You hear what I'm saying? So once I see the daughter of the king, the head of Shimon, the daughter of... I say, hold it. There's something going on here which transcends the personal relationships. There's something much more going on. It sounds to me like there's something ideological going on. Furthermore, it's stressed in last week's portion, the two of them were right there in front of the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting. And that's a place of holiness. Let's just think for a second. Let's say that these two were attracted to one another. Zimri and Cusby had a thing for one another. They look across the room, their eyes meet, right? So what happens next? I mean, they strip right there in front. I mean, okay, look, I don't know. You guys tell me. I don't know what goes on in bars today, right there on the spot. Yeah, I mean, you'd assume that they would sneak off to some place. He wants to know which bar. Look at this. Yeah, Baruch Hashem. So you would assume that if there was an attraction over here, the two of them would sneak off someplace, go off privately, and then do what they do. But no, there is something going on over there. That's what the Talmud identifies. It says, daughter of the king is herself going out there, and she's got a mission. What's her mission? Seduce Moshe. What happens if you seduce Moshe? That's it. You destroy the Jews. They say, only give yourself up to the man who's the leader. So she gets to the Jewish camp. She's looking around. And then she sees 59,000 people stand up when Zimri walks by. And of course, he's got the biggest tribe. So then she goes, okay, this must be the leader of the Jews. What she didn't understand is the modesty of Moshe and how Moshe would have done everything to avoid people publicly giving him his honor. She sees Zimri over here. Zimri, you know, and Zimri says, I'm the leader of the strongest tribe. I'm the leader of the Jews. So then she gives herself up in. But there's an ideology going on over here. Zimri, on the other hand, what's going on in his mind? It seems to me that the behavior which is taking place here is absolutely connected with the Baal worship. And I intimated this last week. I don't know how clearly I spelled it out. The worship of Baal, we're told, included scatological behavior. It means that they worshipped things, including they would defecate in front of the idols. We hear this, we don't know what they're talking about, what this means. The deeper level is that they worshipped nature. When you worship nature, then everything which is natural becomes elevated, becomes holy. Defecation is holy, then certainly a public expression of sexual relations. It's natural. That was the mind frame of what Baal was. And as you see, Baal made a resurgence in America in the 60s. It's no question. It's the same. It's the exact same philosophy coming back. If it's natural, it's good. That's all. All natural things are good, and therefore this is natural, and it's good. At the risk of repeating myself from last week, I'll say it again anyway. I've had occasions when people have asked me in classes, how can you possibly explain where the Bible says that people used to live for such a long time, when we see today that the people live much shorter? So with Americans, it's really easy. I just say that, and I'm joking, but they believe me. It's the problem. I have to explain to them I'm joking. I say, well, they didn't have any artificial additives then. They only ate natural food. They go, oh, okay. It's that we've come to the point that we so much worship what's natural, people are willing to believe anything about nature. But that's part of the worship as well. Of course, we have not ritualized it quite as much, but almost. We just think next time when you go back and you want to keep kosher, just remember that whoever eats, you know, vegetarian, only natural ingredients or whatever, they're not embarrassed about this at all. They'll get up and they'll say, clearly I want this kind of food, but only those of us that keep kosher, we're a little embarrassed about it. Why? I mean, that's better than this. I mean, it's almost clear. No, but there's this worship going on of what's natural. Okay, that's enough. That's the... Enough with that line. But now we can understand what's going on over here. This public expression of the sexual act is an identification with the Baal worship. It's natural, therefore is good, and therefore you get up and you do it publicly. If it were only an act of passion, they would have snuck away, but this is not an act of passion. This is ideology. What I'm really trying to say then is that this person, Zimri, is also a fanatic. Ah, Pinchas is a fanatic, and Zimri is a fanatic. They're both fanatics. One is a fanatic in terms of God, the other is a fanatic in terms of Baal. Now this connection between Zimri and Pinchas is simply playing out a theme which takes us back to Bereishis. Zimri is the leader of the tribe of Shimon. Pinchas is one of the leaders of the tribe of Levi. Shimon and Levi are brothers. Yaakov on his deathbed says, Shimon v'Levi achim. Shimon and Levi are brothers. They're together. Where is the first time we see Shimon and Levi acting together? Shechem, the city of Shechem. If you remember the story, we're told in Bereishis how the daughter of Yaakov goes out and meets the girls in the neighborhood. Right? It says that that Yaakov comes back to his family, they settle in Israel. It says that she goes out to meet the girls in the neighborhood. This goes back to Bereishis, Genesis chapter 34. In the Stone edition, it's 180, page 180, 181. It says, Vatetze Dina bas Leah, she yelled to Yaakov, Rosbevnosa Aretz. Dina, the daughter of Leah, who was born to Yaakov, which is a funny formulation. The Dina, the daughter of Leah, was born to Yaakov, goes out to see the daughters of the land. She moves into a new neighborhood, so she makes friends with the other girls there. Vayar osa Shechem ben Chamor achivi nesi aretz. And Shechem, the son of Chamor, the Chivite, the prince of the land, Caesar, vayikachosa, he takes her, vayishkavosa, and he sleeps with her, vayanel, and he violated her. In order to understand what's happening over here, there's a parallel between these two verses. The daughter of Yaakov, the son of Shechem. Shechem is the prince of the land. Yaakov is a prince in his own right. Yaakov is a people. Yaakov is the leader of a people. Shechem is the leader of a people. You see, how do I understand this story will depend very much on who the players are. If this is simply a neighborhood story, a girl goes out, she plays with the next door neighbors, and the son of the guy who lives next door starts up with her and violates her. It's a terrible tragedy, but it's a personal tragedy. On the other hand, if the son of the Russian ambassador rapes the daughter of the king of Sweden, that is not a personal tragedy. That becomes a national tragedy. So what was it? The violation of Dina, was it personal or was it national? That's the question over here. The way the text is setting it up, the son of the leader of the land, the daughter of Yaakov. So what's interesting over here, and now is not the time to read this through carefully, but what's interesting over here is that two different perspectives on what's going on. Yaakov has one perspective, and his sons have a different perspective. What is Yaakov here? It says, Vayakov shama ki time is Dina bito. Yaakov hears his daughter was violated. So who was violated? His daughter. His sons come in, uvne Yaakov bo min asada, and the sons of Yaakov come in, ukishamam, when they heard what happened. It doesn't say what they heard. Vayitatzvu anashim, and they got very depressed, very angry. Vayichar lahim ma'od, extremely upset. Why? Ki nivala asa b'Yisrael, for an outrage had been committed in Israel. Do you know what's interesting about this verse? It sounds good, but you know what's interesting? We don't even notice what it is. It's the first time they're ever called Israel as a people. It's the first occurrence of it. What did they hear? An outrage took place in Israel. Hold it. They did not hear a neighborhood. They did not hear about an incident between two neighbors. What did they hear? The daughter of Yaakov, the daughter of the king, was violated. An outrage took place in Israel. Lishkav is bas Yaakov, to sleep with the daughter of Yaakov. Why? The daughter of Yaakov is aristocracy. Who's the son of Hamor? Who's Hamor, the son of Shechem? He's the leader of the people. They see an international incident. Yaakov sees a local incident. When they go and they wipe out the whole city, what's Yaakov's complaint? How can you do such a thing to me? I'm so small a number. Yaakov sees it pragmatically. And what do they answer? Anybody remember? Hachizona Yaseh Achoseinu? Will our sister be turned into a prostitute? And Yaakov doesn't answer. But, you know, it's very interesting because they're not speaking to one another clearly. This is not the sort of conversation you would expect. Yaakov gives pragmatic, political, maybe even military considerations. I am small in number. If my children wipe out a town, I now am open to attack by the next town and the next town and the next town. Who knows what kind of treaties these people had with other tribes. And what's their response? But we'll make our daughter into a prostitute. Yaakov's talking pragmatism, and they're talking honor. The Targum, by the way, is also very interesting. The Targum links together the answers. The Targum, not Unkelos, Yerushalmi says that what will the Jews say, what will our descendants say in the future when they read this portion in the Chumash, in the synagogue? Year after year, they're going to come back and they're going to read this, how she was violated. In the future, what are they going to say about this if we would do nothing? Which means they're looking at it as if the Jewish people exist. The daughter of Yaakov, a princess, is attacked like this and we did nothing about it? Which means they're looking at things in the future, and Yaakov doesn't answer that. It's silence. So they have two different views. Yaakov's view is much more pragmatic. We're small in number right now. They're looking at it honor and a national thing. Yaakov is pragmatic, and the brothers deal with a national issue. But this is very interesting, because who were the two brothers who wiped out the city? Shimon and Levi. Those were the two. Shimon and Levi, they are full of anger, venom, I hope my language isn't too strong, and they go out and they wipe out the city. Yaakov waits till his deathbed to respond. I want to read his response carefully. This takes us to page 276, 277, chapter 49, verses 5 and 6. Shimon v'Levi achim, Shimon and Levi are brothers. Kilei chamas mechurasehim. Their weaponry is a stolen craft. Bisodam al tavo nafshi. Into their conspiracy may my soul not enter. Al techad kvodi. Excuse me. Bisodam al tavo nafshi. Bikolam al techad kvodi. And in their congregation I don't want to join. Ki ba'apam hargu ish. For with their rage they murdered people. Uveritzonam ikushor. And with their whim, they strung up an ox. By the way, that second thing about the ox is generally accepted. Rashi tells us, as a reference to Yosef, that the conspiracy against Yosef, as far as Yaakov is concerned, and this would indicate that Yaakov knew at the end what happened with Yosef, and he blamed Shimon and Levi. They were his fanatical sons. They're the ones who take the law into their hands. They're the ones who he blames for what happened to Yosef. They're the ones who he understands threw them in the pit. Over there, when it talks about the sale of Yosef, it says, one said to his brother. So who were the two that were brothers? Shimon and Levi. How do I know it says it? Shimon and Levi Achim. So it says, Ish El Achiv, then one said to his brother, these are the two that were closest. Shimon and Levi are inseparable. Shimon and Levi are together on a mission, together with anger, fanatics, bound forever to go out and make sure that justice in their way will always be carried out. Now, Yaakov Avinu says, they're violent, I don't want to be a part of them. And then he says in verse 7, Arur apam ki az, accursed, or their rage, for it is intense. Let their rage be cursed, because it's a very strong rage. Ve'evrasam ki kashasa, and their wrath, for it's harsh. Achalkein b'Yaakov, let them be divided, the Jewish people, va'afitzein b'Yisrael, and dispersed among Israel. And that's the parting wish. or blessing, if you will. What is Yaakov saying? The anger is really bad. Got to get away from that anger. They're both fanatics. And what's Yaakov finally saying? They got to go in different directions. They got to separate. Because together, when you have two of them together, I mean, you know, it's a good team when one person wants to go out and the other person, you know, calms them down a little bit. When you have this, I don't want to say yin and yang, that's too popularistic. When you have between two people a joint effort where each one complements the other. These two of them, they're both, you know, one says, let's go out and kill, and the other says, yeah, let's go, let's do it. They need someone to temper the violence.
So could it be that Kenneth had read the Torah?
Of course. Of course.
Prophecy.
Of course. Shimon and Levi, okay, it's good what you're doing, you're going ahead, but now we see the antecedents. Shimon and Levi are the ones who are full, they're the, if I can borrow a term from Billy Joel, can I? They're the angry young men. And Yaakov says, separate them, get them apart. There are times that we have to make extreme actions, but the anger is what takes us out of our equilibrium. It's the anger which sometimes affects our decision-making process. Yaakov attacks the anger, and he says, they bound together, they just go. Moshe was from Shevet Levi. Moshe was the tribe of Levi. What is the first expression that we see Moshe making as a Jew? Moshe's first action of Jewish identity. When does Moshe come out of the closet, come out of his Egyptian past? When? When he sees the Egyptian abusing the Jew, Moshe sees a Jew's life on the line. Moshe says, I will involve myself in that. And he goes and he saves the Jew's life and he kills the Egyptian in the process. Moshe is descendant of Levi. Moshe, that's it. Moshe's following his family. He's following his tradition. But Moshe's doing it totally dedicated towards God. A Jew's life is being threatened right now. It's not a vigilante act. You're not going back and taking revenge. Moshe sees something, he responds. When Moshe comes down with the tablets, and the people are worshiping the golden calf, and Moshe smashes the tablets, and then he calls out and he says, Mi LaHashem Eli. Who? Whoever is with God, join me. Who does the Torah say rallies behind him? The whole tribe of Levi. Moshe is calling, who's with me? The tribe of Levi's with him. That is the reason the tribe of Levi receive the kahuna. They receive the rights to be the Kohen and the Levium, the ones who work in the temple. Because Mila Hashem Eli, who is with God? Let's go forward. Who's with God? The tribe of Levi is with God. But what's fascinating is the tribe of Levi then go and they help Moshe execute the people that were guilty of the golden calf. Isn't that fanaticism? It is, but now we see that the tribe of Levi have been able to gather all of their fanaticism and use it directly in their relationship with God. And therefore, Levi becomes one of the most important tribes that we have. We follow through and now we get back to this week's parsha. And now we could see the parallels that I've been hinting at. All those years before, when Dinah, this princess, was violated by this prince, the same thing is happening right now publicly. A prince and a princess together. But now Shimon, instead of attacking, Shimon is leading it. See, Shimon, Zimri from the tribe of Shimon, is still a fanatic. But it's sort of like he missed the boat. Instead of using it towards worship of God, he's using it in some sort of tainted manner. Make no mistake about it. This is not an individual action. It's not just Pinchas. Excuse me, it's not just Zimri. He has the support of his tribe. How do I know that? We're told 24,000 people died. So how do we figure out what tribe those 24,000 people were from? The census. There's a census made in this week's portion immediately after what happened. And the census goes through all the tribes. We compare the census over here with the previous census that was made. You know what we find? The Rav Shimon went from approximately 59,000 down to 22,000. We find the largest negative differential is in the tribe of Shimon. Rashi therefore says, quote, it seems to me that all 24,000 that died were from the tribe of Shimon. Which means this tragedy represented by Zimri actually is a tragedy which transcends the individual and has to do with the entire tribe. All of the followers were from Shimon. So now when Moshe comes down from the mountain and who is with me, and the whole tribe of Levi rallies behind Moshe, when Zimri is about to have public relations with Cozbi, and you know, who is with me? Don't you see it's the same thing, but it's the complete reverse. It's the same sort of behavior. It's fanaticism. But it's fanaticism not being channeled towards a relationship with God. It's fanaticism being totally misused and used to rebel against God. And therefore Zimri leads this march towards Baal, this march towards idolatry, and 24,000 of his followers from his tribe perish with this mistake. It wasn't any tribe that you can get to follow, it was Shimon. Shimon and Levi are brothers. Yaakov says, we've got to divide them. Two different directions. And indeed they go in two different directions. If you go to the very end of the Chumash, we know that Moshe gives blessings to all of the tribes. Correct? Does anybody remember, without looking in, what the blessing is that he gives to Levi? Ulevi Amar, and to Levi he said, I'm on page 1114, chapter 33, verse 8, in Devarim. Ulevi Amar, to Mecha v'urecha le'ish chasidecha. Of Levi, he said, your Tumim and your Urim befit your devout one. He's considered the one who's devout. Ish chasidecha, the man of chesed, the man of kindness. And it goes on, this beautiful blessing, verse 10, Yoru mishpatecha liyakov v'sarascha liyisrael. You will teach the laws to Jacob and the Torah to Israel. And it goes on with all these great things that Levi will do. Now here's my question. Does anybody know the blessing that Moshe gives to Shimon before he dies? You know it? What? There wasn't one. Moshe blesses the other 11 tribes and says nothing to Shimon. Obviously Moshe's mother once told him, if nothing nice to say, then don't say anything. But if you say, I'm only partially kidding. Because it stands, and people never notice it. It was very good that you knew that, actually. Because it's this great trick question to ask people, what does Moshe say to Shimon? What's the blessing? And people start scratching their heads, saying, I don't remember. Of course they don't remember, he doesn't say anything. And it's really bizarre that Moshe will say something about the other tribes, but Shimon, nothing. Shimon is this tragedy. Moshe saw the tragedy. Moshe saw the way that it played itself out. Shimon Shimon remains the angry young man. Shimon never, in a sense, grows up. Shimon never learns how to challenge his greatness towards worship of God. Say it again. Most likely it's connected. They need to be blessed. But Moshe is a prophet. Moshe is looking at them. Moshe is identifying the role of Levi. And when it comes down to Shimon, Shimon is not able to do it. Now again, the lesson of this week's parsha is very, very simple. You have two people with the same quote-unquote genetic makeup. Shimon and Levi Achim. Shimon and Levi are the same. They're brothers. I don't know if they're twins. I doubt it. It doesn't seem that way from back in Bereshis. They're brothers. They're very, very close with one another. But they go in different directions. I mean, it's so popular today for people to hide behind genetic or other excuses. They were brought up in the same place. They have the same outlook. They have the same temper. But Shimon misuses it and Levi channels it. I mean, isn't that one of the major lessons of Judaism? We say, Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz mi yirshamayim. Everything's in the hand of heaven, except for fear of heaven. The hand that God deals us is set. What we do with it is up to us. The genetic makeup we have, that's not the excuse. Now, how do we use it? How do we channel it? Shimon fails, Levi succeeds. Levi becomes these people that are able to focus on God exclusively. And now we see how much Pinchas was really from Levi. Pinchas does this because it's totally the right thing to do. It's unpopular what he's going to do. People will accuse him of all sorts of terrible things. People will say that he's not like Aaron. Why? Because Aaron is really a man of chesed, like we see at Levi. Aaron is a kind man. Aaron's a man who helps people. Aaron doesn't go around killing people. And the Torah says, no, what Pinchas did over here, he is a descendant of Aaron. He is like Aaron. He did this out of kindness for the Jewish people. Out of kindness? I mean, I hope that you don't think that this is twisted. Charles Manson said that he killed all the people he killed as an act of kindness. You really love somebody, you'll free them from this world. That's not what I'm talking about. Pinchas sees something evil taking place in front of him, in front of Moshe, in front of the tent of meeting. Zimri uses all of his power of persuasion, to convince his entire tribe, or many people in the tribe, half of his tribe literally, gather together in front of Moshe and everybody, publicly rejecting Moshe, rejecting Torah, rejecting God. And Pinchas says, if we don't stop them, who knows where this is going to lead. Realize it's a very seductive ideology. The Gemara tells us the Jews never believed in idolatry. But if all that you have to do is worship a little idolatry, and then you can have sex with whoever you want publicly, it sounds like a good deal. That's what the Talmud says. And if you think about that, that's exactly what happened in last week's portion. These guys start sleeping with the girls, and then they say, okay, now worship the idols. Say, okay, worship the idols. And then the price of continuing the relationship is to keep on worshiping? Fine, we'll keep on worshiping it. Because the Jews didn't fall for the idolatry itself. But if I adopt this philosophy, now it gives me license to do whatever I want to do, and it identifies with really the base parts of the human soul, or may not be the soul, of the body. And Zimri's getting up and saying, come on, free love, right? Free love. And Pinchas says, this is not free love. It's free sex. There's a very big difference between the two. This is not something which is elevated. This is something which is a desecration. And therefore you have two fanatics standing up one against the other. And Levi, Pinchas from Levi, has to stand up and stop him. Stop Zimri. And that's the tragedy. See, this is the watershed. This is the moment that you see them going in different directions. We could have sensed it earlier with Moshe. We could have sensed it earlier by the ego, by the golden calf. But now we see it clearly. Now we see, and no place is as clear as this, Shimon and Levi, two different directions. One tribe will remain in the temple, remain the teachers of the Jewish people, and the other tribe, what we really see, is infamy. The Rambam, in a celebrated passage, tells us, don't think for a second that only Levi is capable of such great behavior. He says all Jews are capable of it. And how do you do it? You decide that I am dedicating myself to God. And that real decision, that real dedication, is what Levi was about. And he says, don't think it's only Levi. Everybody's capable of it. And that's really what free will is. Levi just becomes the one who does it more than anyone else. And you could have said that if I would have stopped the story all the way back in Genesis, Yaakov was quite upset. But Yaakov realized that it wasn't the behavior itself, that's not the issue. Is that there is a trait involved over here. And that trait, when the two of them came together, it was catastrophic. Yaakov understood, you've got to separate them. Once they separate, they're each free. Together, it was too dangerous, too volatile. When you separated them, Levi rose, and Shimon, of course, seems to have failed. And of course, Moshe's silence at the end of Devarim speaks very, very loudly. Moshe says nothing about Shimon.